Welcome to Psych Tech, the Psychology and Technology Podcast. I am Josue Cardona with Kelly Dunlap. Kelly, what were we talking about this week?
Well, inspired by Orange is the New Black, we're going to be talking about technology in the prison system, specifically around mental health.
You know, one of the things that I like that we, or the way that we do things here is that we usually find an article that kind of sparks our interest and gets us talking. And you found a really good article, at least very interesting, because it's kind of, it's short, it just has enough to get you thinking, right? It was on Fast Company, it's called How Technology Could Improve Mental Health in Prisons, But So Far Isn't. And there's a lot of interesting points there that I think we can say a few things about.
Yeah, I mean, I'll open up with I used to work in the correctional system. When I was an undergrad, I worked with sex offenders. When I was in graduate school, I worked in a pretrial agency. So people who'd been arrested but hadn't gone to trial yet, I worked with them on mental health issues. And I also worked in a pre-release center. So people who had, you know, nonviolent offenses and had a year or two left, it was kind of almost like a halfway house. So I guess you could say I worked through the entire process of, you know, from being arrested to being released. So this is kind of a pet issue of mine is mental health in the correctional facility.
Interesting. Yeah, my minor was in forensic counseling, which essentially means the entire legal system. And while I didn't work in prisons directly or with people who were, you know, in the system, I did work with family members. So lots of kids whose parents were in prison or parents who had been in prison, you know, it was a part of the family dynamic. And so that's where I'm coming from. In your experience, was technology, did it play a role at all in the kind of work that you were doing?
Mostly that it was absent.
Did you feel an absence? Like, did you feel that you needed some in any aspect of the work that you were doing?
I think the best example is when I was working at the pre-release center. Again, those are people who are about to be released back into society, got a year or so left. And they would ask questions, just really basic things like, how do I get a social security card? Or where do I go to get my driver's license? Things that are, you know, really easy to look up if you don't know. Because I've had the same questions. I don't, you know, where is the DMV? How do I find it? But they didn't have access to any technology that would actually make that happen. And it made them really reliant on us as providers to kind of get them that information, or, you know, having to take extra time to, say, go to the library to be able to use a computer. And so I feel like the lack of technology made their lives so much harder than it needed to be.
Yeah, the author of the Fast Company article, Dr. Vahab Zadir, he mentions that. And it surprised me that that came up on his list of issues. And in the context that he mentioned, it was very similar to what you just said, that there's this aspect, this social work aspect, right, of navigating the system. And if they trust you enough to work with you, they may trust you enough to ask you these questions about things that they're curious about and they probably need to know. And they are asking you, and that's not really your role there, but you may not even have access to the technology you need at that moment to even help them out, even if you had the time or if that was part of the work that you were doing.
Yeah, I can distinctly remember one of the last things that happened to me before I left the pre-release center is one of the residents came in, and it was like her last day or almost last day. And we were talking about our families, and she wanted to show me pictures of her kids. And she was Russian by birth, and she spoke Russian was her first language. And so I was like, okay. So I pulled up Facebook on the computer, and she put in her profile. And so we were looking at, you know, her kids and, you know, all this other stuff, and it's in Russian, and it was no big deal. And then the next day I got pulled into a meeting saying, you know, there was unlawful access and we might have to revoke this person's release. And it was this huge deal. And I felt terrible that, you know, I felt like I had put her in this situation where she might lose her freedom, and I felt sick about it. And I mean, everything turned out okay and she was released on time. But I mean, even just something as simple as wanting to connect with another person by showing photos was, you know, that almost got her in a huge amount of trouble.
This reminds me of something I forgot to look up for the episode, so I don't have it in my notes. But it was, I recently saw that these inmates had built a computer, essentially, and were hiding it in the ceiling. Did you see this?
No.
Okay, I need to look this up, and I'll put it in the show notes because I don't remember any details right now. But I remember seeing it in the last few weeks, and I can't believe I forgot to bring it up here. Although it's not, I mean, it does have to do with technology access, but it's not necessarily with the mental health treatment aspect, right? But I do think that the access to information is about being self-sufficient. Right. And that's a big role. I mean, that plays a big role in your mental health.
Absolutely. And I mean, one of the reasons that we're talking about mental health in the realm of the correctional system is that so the U.S. correctional system houses 10 times more people with mental illness than all of the country's mental health hospitals combined. So in other words, the U.S. correctional system is the largest provider of mental health services in the country, which is staggering if you think about how underfunded and undersupported mental health treatment in jails and prisons is.
Yeah, the stats are always, they're everywhere, right? Like you hear them all the time. The numbers are so big, just like how many people we have in jails compared to the rest of the world. It's just, the numbers are staggering, right? It's a little overwhelming to think about those numbers. And then to look at it just from a mental health perspective, to think that our prison system is the biggest mental health system then, right? Or mental health treatment system in the country.
Yep.
Yeah. I listened to a podcast recently on the Vox podcast network. It's the Ezra Klein Show. And he interviewed someone named Dr. Nika Jones-Tapia. And she's a clinical psychologist. And she is the executive director of the Cook County Department of Corrections, which is in North Carolina. And apparently she's the first mental health professional to ever run a large prison system. And that conversation is really, really interesting. I'll put that in the show notes too, because it just goes to show that there aren't people with a mental health background or who are thinking about that at the forefront, you know, making these decisions or in charge of anything in these places. And the things that they've done there have been really interesting. And they talk about how Cook County Department of Corrections in particular is one of the largest in the country. So by itself, you know, if the prison system is the largest mental health provider, then Cook County is then maybe the largest provider of mental health services in the country. And it's a prison system.
And I mean, if you think about it, even in terms of something as simple as people making sure people get their medication, their appropriate medication, the article that Josue mentioned at the top of the show talked about how the difficulty of just even figuring out someone's patient history, because a lot of the information is either not online or the systems that communicate it don't communicate with one another. So if you get moved from one jail to another, or from a jail to a prison, or from max to min, or you know, people in prison move around a lot, you know, all that information can be lost. And then on top of that, even something like, you know, being in jail and going to see a therapist carries a stigma with it. And you know, if you're afraid of seeming weak on when you're on the outside, imagine what the stigma might be when you're incarcerated and you're going to see a therapist or a psychiatrist. Like there's so many things going on that just make it almost, to me, inhumane to have a mental illness in jail to begin with.
Yeah. One of the first things that he mentions in the article is stigma. And then he goes on to talk about privacy, right? You don't have the same type of privacy that you have outside, because you're more visible there, right? I mean, it doesn't have to be that way. There could be the same kind of privacy where nobody knows that you're necessarily going to get treatment, but apparently it's a bigger problem in prisons. And I mean, I can imagine many of the reasons why that is, but that's something that isn't taken into consideration. And it's interesting because those two, they aren't really technology related, but technology can help to fix those things.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even something like you know, video remote therapy. You know, the military's been doing that for a long time. I saw a bunch of articles talking about how prisons that are, or at least forward-thinking in terms of mental health, are bringing in, you know, tablets and whatnot so people can have remote sessions with therapists, because it costs a lot of money to bring in a therapist, especially if you've got hundreds of people that might need care.
That's a good point. I mean, right, if there is just like a special room where you go for stuff, right? People don't have to know what that is. So there's no doctor going in and out. You could meet with multiple people because you're doing it remotely. So that's like a very simple way that we could use technology to kind of help with the stigma and the privacy around getting treatment to begin with, right? Like, I mean, there's structural and like infrastructure things that could be done, but yeah, that's like the simplest way to do it. And on the health record point, right? An electronic medical record, for example, like that's just a problem that we have in the United States overall, right? Nobody's talking, like doctors aren't talking to each other. You don't have a record of your own. I remember a few years ago, Google Health, I think it was called. And the idea was that you would have your medical record online. So you would add all your information there. So then, you know, wherever you went, you could add your information to that. And I'm assuming the idea was that doctors would take part and submit the data to it. But eventually that was scrapped, and the website doesn't even exist anymore. And it's unfortunate that, you know, people are trying that, but with all the different systems and because of the laws that we have, it's so difficult to just collect all that information. Like if you're an adult and someone asks you for your vaccination records, like I still have this little book from when I was a kid. It's like, I think Tylenol was a sponsor, and it's got like stickers and stuff on it. And that's my old vaccination record. You know, we do not do that well here in the United States. And within the prison system, it's kind of unfortunate that it seems to be even worse, right? Like and I don't know if you found this problem, even just within mental health, where you would meet with someone and eventually they get to the point where like, yeah, you're like the 10th therapist that I've talked to, and I've already gone through all this stuff. And why do I have to do it again? And we had no idea.
Exactly. And I think one of the things about Psych Tech as a podcast is we're usually kind of futurists. We're very future oriented and looking at the next cool technology thing to come down the pike. And I think the most interesting thing about looking at mental health and corrections and technology is that we're not really future facing. We're not, you know, thinking about, oh, wouldn't it be cool if there was some kind of robot? I mean, we're literally talking about just having systems that can communicate so a person can get their medication they need.
Yeah, it's almost like technology for just basic necessities.
It's like remedial technology.
In a way, yeah. Yeah. some of the other things that article mentions are that there's a huge technology divide between inside the prison and outside the prison. From his observation, I'm sure that, you know, that varies from facility to facility. But actually, you mentioned Orange is the New Black. That's one of the things about that show, right? That I forgot what season it was, where they're essentially like they're broke. Like they don't have the money to do basic things like get new beds or uniforms, I think, right? So where does technology play a role in that? Technology that could, you know, and it not only make the or improve the mental health of the inmates, but also the entire process. And, you know, I'll extend that even to the mental health of the people who work at the correctional facility, and not just in mental health, but just in general, even in security. There's so many things that could just make everybody's life a little bit easier. And apparently that's not a priority, which is kind of weird. One of the things that the article mentions is that there's like, we talk about Silicon Valley and all the new apps and all the new technology and stuff. And a lot of that is based on research, on user research. So those are, you and I download the app and we're testing it and we're giving data for free. And the app keeps getting updated and updated. But it's based on our use and we're not in prison. So the data doesn't necessarily apply. So there's all this technology out there that has little to no research applied to that particular user group. So it may not be very helpful. And in many cases, it is not.
Yeah. I mean, generalizability is always an issue. And, you know, in clinical trials, whether it's medical or psychological, you know, when they're trying to test either a new drug or a new intervention, they look for the pure patient, you know, the patient that has just pure generalized anxiety disorder or just pure, medical word insert here. And that's just so not realistic to a general population. I mean, obviously, you need to start somewhere and you have a solid foundation for where you're going. But, you know, a lot of the people in the correctionals have multiple diagnoses that are confounded by medical problems. And a lot of them are substance abuse substance abuse related. And I think a lot of the hesitancy around innovating in the incarceration space, I guess, is that people see prison as something that is punitive, and trying to help people is therefore, I don't know, making it okay. I remember working, when I was working in the prison system, people talking about how it wasn't fair that, you know, a prisoner got a bed to sleep in and fresh sheets and got to watch TV, and, you know, they didn't get to do that. And why should we treat, you know, someone who's committed a crime better than we treat people who are law abiding? And it always gets me because, one, everyone should be treated with a basic standard of human decency. You know, if you commit a crime and you are you know, sentenced and you're serving out your term, that doesn't make you less human. You know, you might not get an ice cream social every Sunday, but you are still entitled to some basic human necessities like clean sheets and water and, you know, God forbid, maybe a toilet that you don't have to pee in front of somebody else. And that doesn't mean that the person who's law-abiding doesn't deserve something at least that good as well. It's like it's like the argument against the minimum wage. Oh, fast food workers shouldn't make $15 an hour because I'm a architect and I don't even make that. Well, maybe it's that you should be paid more too. Like it's if you're trying to raise up somebody else, it doesn't mean that you're trying to put another down. And I think that's a large part of why prisons are as bad and at addressing mental health issues, at addressing like just basic human rights issues, is because it's really hard to be pro-prisoner, you know?
You know, there's a lot of political beliefs at play there. And wherever anyone is on the spectrum, the prison system, there's money there. There's a lot of money. And apparently nobody wants to spend money on the things that we're talking about. Because if someone were to invest, you know, there's somebody out there who's willing to make an app or adjust or change the technology to apply it to a different setting, right? If the money's there, if there's kind of an incentive. And unfortunately, you know, if there's some sort of decision at the top, right, where it's like, well, this is a priority now and it is more humane and something else, well then, you know, I think as long as the money's there, it can happen. But it's not gonna just someone in San Francisco isn't just going to go ahead and say, hey, yeah, I'm going to do this because I care about this population or because I care about what's going on in this space. We don't see that much. Although I do have an example that I'll bring up in a little bit. But
oh, we got to wait for it.
Yeah. Because there's only one more thing in that Fast Company article that I wanted to touch on at least, which is that he talks about the potential use of big data for being proactive and, you know, in order to get that data, you would have to collect data. So that's kind of where it gets into a little more future forecasting. He talks a little bit about wearables, a little bit about computer vision. You know, if you monitor audio and video, and now we're getting into privacy and all these other things, but if you're able to have a device, like imagine the prison equivalent of a, you know, an Amazon Echo or a Google Home or something like that, built with a completely different, with like a mental health focus, where it's monitoring for very particular cues and it's collecting data so it can make adjustments to your treatment, right? Something that can inform your provider. There's a lot of potential there, but apparently nobody's doing that. Again, in that space, again, I mean, we'll go back to what you said. Probably nobody cares to do that, but we do have technology that's available, and I've talked about it in the past. You know, like being able to do like behavioral imaging and things like that, but that costs a lot of money. Like even when I had my private practice, to get somebody who was willing to pay for something like that was expensive, even though we have the technology, because insurance wasn't going to cover it. And that's like a really great thing to have. And it is so proactive that most people won't invest in it.
Josue, can you talk a little bit about what behavioral imaging is?
Sure. So behavior imaging, it's essentially, it's one way of referring to using audio and video in particular, to monitor behavior and then review that footage afterwards. So imagine having Or one example is you have a kid who has many outbursts and the parent is out of control. The parent feels that they have no control. They don't know what to do. So you would set up a device that essentially records the child in a play area or somewhere, wherever that kind of experience usually happens. And then a behavior imaging specialist, a behaviorist, psychologist, someone could go and review that footage to get an idea of what cued the behavior, what triggered it, what was happening, how to deal with it, and essentially review it afterwards. And it's very different from how when you go to a therapist and you're just talking to them about what happened and kind of reviewing it from memory. It's very different if you actually have the footage, then you can go through it. And some of those systems are available where you know, the person who's reviewing the data can actually mark different pieces and comment on the video so that there's a lot of information to work with. The article doesn't mention behavior imaging in particular, and that's just one term for this type of technology application. But the article does mention computer vision. Essentially, you know, if the computer itself could do a review or could be scanning for particular cues that could then inform treatment or inform your record in general to be able to help the facility kind of see what's going on, maybe understand better. And of course, I'm looking at this as a way to help. I can see how I would probably be more successful if I sold it as a way to be a better jailer, right? Just be a better monitor of behavior. I can see how it could have both applications, but maybe you could have any kind of like additional recording but have that AI layer onto it that is looking specifically for mental health related issues and looking for ways that it could help. Like, for example, there are PTSD symptoms that aren't visible until like late at night or under very specific conditions or while you're sleeping. And maybe you're not totally aware of them because you're sleeping or you just don't have that self-awareness. And this kind of footage could really help with something like that.
And even at the end of the day, I think one of the biggest struggles that we're going to see in this area is that even if the technology's there, people still have to consent to use it. You know, if there was a behavioral imaging thing, posted in each cell block or in the mess area or something like that, or a wearable that would track an inmate's stress level and pulse and maybe alert you to if someone's having a hard time or, you know, getting ready to need some kind of intervention. But again, these are all things that somebody would have to consent to. And I have a hard time wrapping my brain around a society that embraces the treatment of mental health with that kind of openness, much less, you know, an incarceration society that does it as well. So I don't know what the solution is in terms of changing that kind of culture, because it's pervasive and it's everywhere. And, you know, I can only imagine for a moment, let's pretend that this is a utopia inside the jail cell and you get rehabilitated and you take your meds and all of a sudden you go out into our current society and once again it's stigmatized. Like, it just, so much needs to change. It almost feels overwhelming. But that's what technology is for, to take it step by step. And, you know, not hopefully, someday it'll be invisible so you can get the help you need without being stigmatized. But maybe one day it'll be available where it's not so visible, kind of like one of those Nicoderm CQ patches that you can't really see. And so you can get the help you need, because I figure the technology is going to change faster than society will.
So many inmates lose certain rights. Is there still, I mean, and I don't know if this varies, is there still a, like, do they lose the right to consent for something like this? Like, if we were, like, I know we're looking at, you know, Big Brother territory here, right? We're complete monitoring. But would it be possible for an inmate to, like, lose their right to consent? So it doesn't matter whether they want it or not. This is just the way that the prison is run?
The only thing I can think of is if it's court ordered. So a person, no matter their crime, has the right to refuse medical treatment, which is what, at least in my mind, this would be processed under, is medical treatment or intervention. So, you know, you can refuse medication, you can refuse treatment, you can refuse resuscitation, things like that. And the only thing that overrides that is a court order. So I think, at least for right now, that's what you would need to have that kind of thing be compulsory.
I'm not sure where I fall on any of this stuff, right? But as a mental health professional, the idea of being able to provide some sort of support even when you're not there, or even just having more, again, I don't want to use the word monitoring, but just being more attentive of your clients, of your patients. Technology can help to do that because we can collect more data. But on the other end, it's that it is so much an invasion of privacy. And I'm fascinated by these conversations in the consumer space where people talk about how, or I'm hearing more and more people say, well, like, yeah, I don't care if the Google Home is listening to me now because I really like just asking it what the weather is, and that always surprises me. and the more time goes by, the more people I hear referring to their technology that way, like, yeah, it's super invasive, but whatever. I like that convenience and I'm willing to forfeit that. And at least personally, I like I'm okay with sacrificing some of my own privacy for not convenience, but for better health outcomes. And I know that not everybody would agree with that. And that's as someone who would potentially be sacrificing their privacy. As someone who would be reviewing other people's information, I have completely different thoughts and feelings about it. So it is complicated, but it does have a lot to do with, the recipient's willingness to give up a part of yourself.
Yeah, I'm always going to come down on the side of consent. And so I feel very strongly about that. The idea of even in a prison, like compulsory monitoring, it gives me the creeps and the heebie-jeebies, so to speak.
Sure. We're assuming that everybody can consent, right? Or has the right to say no, that they don't want this to happen, how many people would or wouldn't? And I know that when we're talking about the prison system, it's very different because in that case, there are decisions that are being made for you and to you, right? Versus, again, outside in the consumer space. But there are the parallels within health and mental health are there. And I really don't have information to kind of guess either way, because here we're talking specifically about mental health, but there's a spectrum, right, of is it rehabilitation or is it mental health treatment? And then at what case, do you agree with the rehabilitation or do you agree with the mental health treatment? Are they different things? Are they the same thing? Like, that's a conversation that could get really, really, really complicated.
Yeah, but consent is really important to me.
No, I know. Nobody's arguing against consent. I'm saying.
I don't know. You seem to be into this Big Brother thing. So I don't know.
But I'm saying you have the choice. Would you agree to it? Would you agree to give all your information up? Would you agree to have that all of it, to make that all available to the system so that they could provide services?
Well, I would be an absolute pain in the butt because I would absolutely demand to know, what are you doing with my data? How is it secured? Is my data safe? All those fun questions that I ask about, and then make a decision. But then again, I come from a very unique place, and I can understand why not everybody might be thinking that. And honestly, if I was incarcerated, that probably would not be the first thing on my mind.
So, but there are scenarios where you would sacrifice. I mean, I think we've talked about this in the past, right? Like, you do have devices that see you and listen to you, and you're okay with that.
Yeah, I mean, my phone knows where I am at all times.
This is true. This is true.
But kind of going back to the compulsory thing, and it makes me feel, not this article in particular, but the next one that was kind of folded into this, the VR treatment, or rather VR being used as treatment in correctional facilities. I watched the video and I read the article, and all I could think of was that scene from Clockwork Orange when they have his eyes peeled open and he has to watch that video.
But were they forced to? Were they being obligated to? Were their eyes glued to the VR headset?
No, not yet.
It's a little different, right?
Not yet, but I could see, if someone finds a you know, some kind of treatment. And again, this is why I'm all about making it not compulsory. But so there's a company called VR Rehab, and they're trying to make treatments specifically for prison populations around different rehabilitation strategies, one of which is specifically pertaining to like substance use and alcoholism. And there's the video that I'll think we can link to in the show notes, where it's a VR experience, and you're talking with your coworkers at the construction site, and they offer you a beer, and you have to say no, and it graphically it looks horrific, and it makes me cringe in all sorts of different ways. But on the other hand, it's cool. At least somebody is trying to take current technology and use it for good. There's no studies or results as to the effectiveness of this particular intervention yet, but I think it could be really cool, or it could be really, really awful.
Yeah, we could say that about a lot of mental health treatment. And VR assisted, right, treatment is a thing. There's different versions of it, and yeah, that is cool to see an application that is specifically geared towards that, right? Because you would have to have some sort of there need to be certain approvals. It needs to meet certain requirements. And to think that somebody's doing that, again, there's money in the prison system. So if somebody's willing to, somebody somewhere must be making the case for that type of treatment being more effective or faster than some other option for particular issues.
Well, I mean, VR has a track record of treating, at least PTSD-related illnesses and phobias and things like that. So at least there is some, evidence base from which it comes. But again, if you look at the graphics, it's like, this is terrible. No one's going to want to do this.
Yeah, but I mean, we've talked in the past about how VR, even when it doesn't look great, it's still, once you're in there, like you're buying it, right? Even though it doesn't look great. And that can improve over time. But just there's this weird idea of the fact that you are incarcerated, you cannot leave, but then someone is able to bring you a device that allows you to have an outside experience. And we've talked about that in the past as a new form of travel or a cheaper way to go to an event. But not until we were preparing for this conversation that I think about it in the sense of, well, you can't leave this location for X amount of years. Who will decide if it's okay or not to allow something like VR? Like, yeah, maybe there's TV, maybe there's other forms of entertainment, but could you have virtual reality that allows you to feel like you're somewhere else? And some people are not okay with that.
Where this line of thinking is making me think of Black Mirror, San Junipero.
Yep. That's a good example of that, right? Where in these are people, right, San Junipero, they're older, they are...
Oh, unable. This is from Black Mirror, by the way, which is a TV show, just in case you don't know.
And they're older, and they're able to kind of escape to this other place, right? But these are people who, I'm assuming, have the funds, and they could go, but it's just harder, right? It's kind of like the tourism example, or maybe even the... And that one is so immersive where it's literally the... Their bodies aren't able to move anymore in some cases, and in this world they can. And we're super far away from that. But that is a good parallel. This does sound like it could be a good Black Mirror episode where there's this whole virtual world full of people who are in prison. Like, how bad is it to be in prison if you can be in a VR world while you're there? Like, what if future prisons are just like in San Junipero. San Junipero, it's kind of like it's a little different. I don't want to spoil it, right? But but it's, imagine like that's a prison system. Like you're just in a pod instead of a full-blown jail system, and then everything happens virtually like in actually Ready Player One, which is coming out next year, where there's kind of this whole other virtual world where everybody really does stuff. Like you live in the real world, but you work and go to school and have fun in a virtual setting. And and I've read about how many people don't want to allow that for prison populations because that's that's seen as being too far from punitive. Even if the graphics are ugly and horrible and it doesn't look realistic at all.
Well, see, now you've got me thinking about the Black Mirror episode White Bear. So,
Yeah. Mm. Well, that's
we'll leave that there.
Yeah. Consent. Whew. So there is one company that I heard about a while ago from a Y Combinator class, and it's called Pigeonly, and the founder, his name is Frederick Hudson, and he was in jail for many years. Essentially, his focus was on helping people who were in jail communicate with the outside world, because it's actually very, very expensive to make a phone call. Like, we take unlimited minutes for granted, but apparently it's very expensive. One number I saw was that he mentioned, like, it's 300 for 300 minutes of talk time, it was like $70. And for someone who has limited time to talk and limited funds, that's really, really hard. So he started a company called Pigeonly to help with that. So essentially, he set up a Skype for prison calls. And it's a lot cheaper to use voice over IP than to make a phone call through this system. And over the years, he's actually developed this entire catalog of products, from being able to send postcards and letters and just make it really easy to send them to the jails. It's very, like, it's all approved. It's like, it doesn't have, you know, nothing is going to get rejected in the sense that, like, it doesn't meet particular requirements. And it's easy to do, and it's very cheap. And essentially, he just wants to help foster communication with the outside world and with family members, because that's such an important part of your mental health. Like, okay, let's say you committed a crime and you're in jail for, even if it's just a few months, like, that's rough, you know? And if you have kids, you have a wife, you have a husband, you have a family outside, and suddenly not being able to connect with them as often, there's some detrimental effects to that. And actually, in that Ezra Klein podcast, Dr. Jones, she talks about how her father was in jail when she was a kid, but her mom, every week, like, she would prepare dinner and they would have family dinner at the jail. And so for her, her father was always an active part of her life, even while he was incarcerated. And so Pigeonly kind of tries to help connect that. And they even have an app called Prison Wives, which it says it's a free support community for wives and girlfriends of the incarcerated. So he's building all of these different technologies and digitizing them, making them way cheaper to essentially help people connect. And I think that's probably the lowest hanging fruit and one of the best ways to help mental health services, or just mental health in general, for this population. At least that's what I've gathered from looking, researching this during the week. And Pigeonly is really one of the only companies that I've seen that has what we were talking about earlier, like that motivation of wanting to help that population, that is thinking about it first, that is not trying to, you know, make money over here and then saying, like, oh, well, there's potentially more money over there. And nobody asked him to do this. This is something that he saw firsthand and he thought would be a good idea to help other people in his situation.
Yep. So the world needs more people like that, who have the skill and the resources to maybe help other people's lives not be so miserable. And I think that goes for, you know, beyond the incarcerated population as well. Technology can do it, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about how easy it is just to communicate all the time, and we definitely take it for granted. And it's so great to see these options available in a creative way, too. I don't know. I love what he's doing at Pigeonly. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. So, you know, on this thread of connecting with people in the outside world, on our sister show, Headshots, we're going to continue the conversation about prison populations and specifically talk about how games can be used to connect with other people and just be a part of your life there. So that'll be next week on Headshots. And I'm glad we kind of wrapped up with Pigeonly because I think it's a good lead-in to what we'll be doing next week. So again, that's on Headshots next week at Headshots Podcast. This is PsychTech at PsychTechPodcast.com. You can find us on Twitter at PsychTechCast. I'm Josue Cardona on Twitter, and Kelly is Kelly N. Dunlap. We are part of the Geek Therapy Network of podcasts. Check us out. All the information from what we talked about is in the show notes, and we will be back in 2 weeks.